Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. In 1946, over a decade before the Soviet Union launched the first satellite, American astrophysicist Lyman Spitzer proposed the idea of putting astronomical telescopes in space, above Earth's obscuring atmosphere. Most of us are quite familiar with the Hubble Space Telescope, one of NASA's great orbiting observatories, but its able partner, named for the man who thought of telescopes in space, the Spitzer Space Telescope, is less well known. And yet, its 15-year mission has yielded amazing discoveries using infrared light to probe the universe. To celebrate Spitzer at 15, we talked to three of its leading scientists. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Mike Werner, project scientist for Spitzer and the team's most veteran member. Werner has been involved with Spitzer since its earliest iterations as a mission planned to be flown on the space shuttle. We'll also talk to Spitzer Science Center director Sean Carey on some of the most amazing discoveries of the orbiting telescope and why infrared light is such an important tool for astronomers observing everything from asteroids and exoplanets to distant galaxies near the beginning of cosmic time. Our first guest is Lisa Story Lombardi. She got her degrees in astronomy and astrophysics from the University of Cambridge and became the project manager for Spitzer at the California Institute of Technology in 2016. She joins us from Caltech via Skype. Well, let's talk about the telescope itself. Can you give us an idea, if we were out in space looking at this telescope, how big is the actual the machine, the observatory itself?
The observatory itself is about 4.5 meters tall. So it is not in the realm of giant space telescopes, is not a giant telescope. The mirror is 85 centimeters in diameter. But it's extremely powerful since it's out in space away from the warmth of the Earth for observing infrared light.
And one of the interesting things about this space telescope is that it has such a unique orbit, where it's actually trailing the Earth. Could you just tell us from an engineering standpoint, tell us about that orbit and what kind of challenges that presents for you guys communicating with the spacecraft?
Absolutely. Yeah, Spitzer, it was unique. It was new and innovative when Spitzer was launched. It's a, it's an Earth trailing orbit. So Spitzer's in orbit around the sun, not the Earth. But that means it's out there all by itself in very, very quiet, dull space, which is excellent for having a thermally stable observing platform. The complicating factor is every year Spitzer is just getting further and further away from the Earth, which makes it more challenging to communicate with. We use the Deep Space Network, and we use the 70-meter radio antennas to communicate with Spitzer. We need the biggest antennas that the Deep Space Network has. And there are three in the world, one in Goldstone, California, one in Australia, and one in Madrid, Spain. Spitzer is... I have a taped to my bulletin board. It's a soda can with a piece of paper folded around one side of it as my model of Spitzer. So the telescope and the instruments and everything is all kind of in this cylindrical tube. And the solar panels are on one side that we always keep pointed to the sun that protect it from, that keep everything else on the back dark. And on the very bottom of the telescope is our antenna that we use to communicate with the Earth. And the antenna isn't articulated. It can't move on its own. So to talk to the spacecraft, you point the bottom of the spacecraft at the Earth. And why that gets challenging, not that it just keeps getting further away, is that also means you're pointing the solar panels away from the sun when we point at the Earth now. So the batteries, we use the batteries and they start to drain. So it is an elaborate dance of how long can we point at the Earth, and not discharge the batteries too much? How much science data can we take and still get in time that we have available to point at the Earth? And the whole mission works together to schedule as much science and fit it into this package so that we can take the science data we want and get it down to the Earth.
So over the years, can you tell us, maybe share one or two moments where you've had some, you know, challenges technologically dealing with Spitzer?
Yes, Spitzer has been a remarkably robust observatory from an engineering standpoint, but it was never designed to operate this far from the Earth, and effectively pitching the telescope over so far to point at the Earth. We had all kinds of fault protection to not allow the observatory to pitch this far. Because during the early part of the mission, when we had cryogen, when we had refrigerant for the instruments that needed to be cold, we didn't want to go too far in either direction away from the sun, worrying about the sun heating up parts of the spacecraft that the sun wasn't supposed to see. And what we've had to do is figure out how to turn off the fault protection so that we can point the antenna at the Earth, and then we've monitored very carefully how does the observatory behave. Just to give you an example, we have, for the prime mission, we would never pitch the observatory further than 30 degrees. So if you think about looking straight overhead and then looking down at the horizon, that would be 90 degrees. So we never pitched further than like a third of the way down. And now to point the observatory at the Earth to take data, we are at close to 50 degrees. And it is still performing just beautifully. It's still thermally stable, even though we're letting the sun shine on parts of the spacecraft that it was never supposed to see.
You know, that sounds like, you know, it must take a team of people and some brilliant engineering minds to come up with the procedures to how you go about doing these things. Can you give us a sense of how many people from an engineering standpoint work on this, controlling the Spitzer Space Telescope?
Let's see. The entire project is about 35 full-time people. We talk about full-time equivalents. It's actually about 50 people, but we have parts of lots of people. I would say about 65% of those are engineers. Our engineering team at Lockheed, who had to do the heavy lifting on figuring out how we could allow the observatory to do these things it wasn't designed to do, is currently only about 6 total people. It's really, truly amazing what they have been able to come up with by thinking outside the box. What, you know, okay, this is how it's set up, but what would happen if we did this, and what are the pieces we need to change to make that possible? And a lot of it we couldn't actually... You know, we like to model everything before we do it, but we couldn't actually model how thermally the spacecraft would behave because it was never designed to do this. But they have figured out procedures for the changes we've needed to make to how the flight software works, and how we could go about testing it basically empirically. That's what we do. We figure out how far... How big an angle do we need to pitch to next year? And then we go try it out. So that's our exciting thing we do once a year, because there's a maximum angle each year. And we've actually just completed that for next year. So we believe we are good to go through November of 2019.
Is that the expected, you know, lifetime for the mission is to 2019, and that's probably it?
That is the funded lifetime. So we thought it initially was impossible to observe past 2013 because we wouldn't necessarily be able to communicate with the spacecraft if we had an anomaly. but the engineers figured out how to do that. Instead of using our high gain antenna, we could get a different signal on the low gain antenna and figure things out from there. And then we all thought, well, the pitch angles are going to get so high in 2015 or 2016, that'll be it. But it's, you know, it's almost 2019 and it's still going strong. So we think we could probably operate in 2020. The communications get more complicated, but we're currently funded through November of 2019.
Well, like you said, it's an extremely robust spacecraft to have lasted this long. Can you give us a sense of what it's like for you as a project manager to facilitate the operations of the spacecraft in conjunction with making sure that you're getting everything that the scientists need? Can you give us a sense of how that works, the partnership between the scientists and then your role with the engineers with, you know, here's what we want to do, and then from their standpoint, here's what we can do to help you achieve that?
Well, it's one of the things I really love about my job. Because since I am a scientist, I started from that perspective. But I have also, I learned really early in the project to really appreciate the engineers on the project, the software and hardware engineers, and how it really requires all of us to make it work. One of the really amazing things about this project is everybody, the engineers and the scientists, are all committed to maximizing the science from Spitzer. So it's very rare. Nobody says, well, oh, no, we can't do that because it wasn't designed to do that. They think about, okay, this is what the scientists would like to do. And then they come back with, well, I think we could do this. And then the scientists work with that and say, okay, well, that will get us to here. And could we try this? It's a partnership, and it's a real collaborative process, which is really fun to work with when it works. And this project has always had really an excellent relationship between all the components. We argue about stuff, and people make their case, and then we decide as a project what's the best way to go. We don't want to break the spacecraft. That won't help the scientists. But we try and push the limits that we believe we can.
Pushing the edge of the envelope of technology to get as much science as you possibly can out of it.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about the legacy of Spitzer from your point of view. Because, of course, the next generation infrared telescope is the much more massive James Webb Space Telescope. What are some of the key lessons from Spitzer and its operations that you think will help that mission be successful?
Well, yes, I think the James Webb Space Telescope, yes, is a much larger telescope. Spitzer really helped define the landscape that the JWST will be operating in terms of Spitzer really opened up the sky at these wavelengths at a sensitivity and resolution that we'd never had before. The James Webb Space Telescope, besides just being a bigger telescope, James Webb has multiple spectrographs. So we're going to be able to not just take pictures, but get basically break down the components, get chemical signatures, and understand more details about astrophysical objects. Some of the things we learned in Spitzer that I know have been applied to JWST in terms of the way we operate and in terms of the way we allowed people to define their observations. We didn't allow people to twist every single possible knob you could have on the observatory. We provided templates that allowed you to make all kinds of choices, but that meant since some of the choices were limited, it means all of the data, we were certain we could calibrate it. And the James Webb Space Telescope, actually most large space observatories now have moved to a method where trying to lay out more of the choices and allow people to pick and choose, but have the software help provide the constraints so that we are certain we're not allowing people to do something where they won't get, you know, decent science data. I think the main legacy of Spitzer, Spitzer has been able to do revolutionary work in the characterization of exoplanets, which is something it completely wasn't, you know, wasn't designed to do at all. And a lot of that work that we're able to do now, either characterizing them or helping, as you know, Kepler's discovered, you know, thousands of planets. We are this year going to be following up targets from the new TESS space telescope that is going to be finding more planets, more exoplanets. And following up with Spitzer, you can help really nail down their orbit so that JWST will know exactly when to point to see the planet, you know, transit in front of a star. So all of the observatories really do work synergistically, even if they're sort of coming one after the other. You can build on the strengths of what came before, just like Spitzer built on the strengths of infrared telescopes that came before it.
Well, on that note, we'll look forward to seeing, you know, what Spitzer does in its final months of operation. And thank you so much for your time telling us about, you know, operating this telescope out in space in this unique orbit with this very interesting and successful instrument.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Blue Dot. After a short break, we'll continue our look at the Spitzer Space Telescope, now in its 15th year of operation, studying the universe in infrared wavelengths. And we're back, thanks to Lisa Story Lombardi, Project Manager for the Spitzer Space Telescope. Next, we're going to talk to a scientist that facilitates sharing Spitzer data with astronomers around the world via the Spitzer Science Center. Sean Carey is the staff astronomer for the Science Center and is responsible for the day-to-day operations that support the scientific research conducted by the orbiting telescope. He joins us via Skype from Pasadena. Sean Carey, welcome to Blue Dot. So you're in charge of the science for the Spitzer Space Telescope. Is that a fair assessment?
It's almost. I'm in charge of the Science Center. So Spitzer's it's an open observatory. So astronomers, actually anybody from all over the world, proposes to use the telescope. So they write down what science they want to do and how they'll use the telescope to do it. And then it's reviewed by a group of astronomers that are selected because they're not working for the Science Center. And then the best proposals get selected and we execute the science. So I help people do their science with a telescope.
Well, let's talk about the Spitzer Space Telescope. It's in its 15th year of operation. And so we're celebrating that with this program. And it's one of NASA's great observatories. Now, I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of the famous Hubble Space Telescope, but not as many people are familiar with Spitzer. Could we start by who is Spitzer named after? Tell us about a little bit about Lyman Spitzer. Who was he?
So Lyman Spitzer was a fantastic astrophysicist. And the two things that I think everybody should know about Lyman Spitzer, well, three, he was an avid mountain climber. So, you know, astronomers just don't look at the stars. They do other things, particularly when the sun's up. The other thing that and important because the telescope actually does a lot of science that Lyman Spitzer did, which is one of the things we do with Spitzer, and one of the things Lyman Spitzer did was study all the stuff in between stars, the interstellar medium. So this is all the gas and dust that's between the stars. And the interesting thing about that gas and dust is that's where the stars come from in the first place. So you want to learn how stars and planets form, you have to know about the stuff that they form out of. And then the second really interesting thing about Lyman Spitzer is he was the first person to propose putting a big telescope in space. And that big telescope ended up being the Hubble Space Telescope, and we know the great things that Hubble's done. And the reasons Lyman had for putting telescopes in space is, well, you got above the atmosphere. So for Hubble and looking invisible light, that stops the twinkling, which blurs your vision. For Spitzer, which is an infrared telescope, looking at longer wavelength radiation, which is associated with heat, which allows you to see cooler objects and also things that are obscured by dust, the atmosphere actually blocks a lot of that infrared light. So you can't do infrared observations very well from the ground, which is why Spitzer's in space.
Yeah, a comparison I like to give to people a lot about, you know, the difference between looking through telescopes on Earth through our atmosphere and in space is it's almost like when you're underwater and you're just looking through your eyes and then you put on a mask and everything clears up.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. Or you're looking through, like, in the case of, like, looking towards the center of our galaxy, it's like if you're looking through a fog bank and trying to look at lights behind it, which are blocked by the fog, but in the infrared, you're able to see all the way through and see to the center of our galaxy. So that's like one of the things that, you know, you have to be able to do to get a, you know, getting above the atmosphere allows you to do.
Well, yeah, let's talk about infrared a bit. I was kind of joking around with you earlier. I've been reading a book by Randall Munroe. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called Thing Explainer. In the book, what he does is he takes complicated ideas and explains them using the 1,000 most commonly used words in the English language. So you can't use a word like electromagnetic radiation. You have to use words like sky colors. And so, you know, going through the electromagnetic spectrum, and we should just kind of briefly do that. We start out with the longest waves, which are radio waves, which are important to me and dear to me because, you know, I have a radio program. And then we get to the microwave region of the spectrum, which carries all of our cellular communications and, you know, heats up the water molecules in our food in food warming boxes, as he calls microwave ovens. And he calls those small waves. And then we get to infrared, which he calls warm waves, because they carry warmth. And then you get to the visible spectrum, that narrow part that we see with our eyes, red, orange, yellow, blue, green, and violet, the colors of the rainbow, the visual light that we can all see. And for centuries, that's all we knew about the universe was what we could see with that kind of light. But now we have all these other ways of looking at things, like ultraviolet light, which is just beyond the violet, those smaller waves that we can't detect, but insects can. And then, you know, finally, X-rays, and I think he refers to those as waves that let doctors see inside your body. And then finally, gamma rays, the most powerful rays. But you work with a telescope that operates with those waves that carry information about heat, right?
That's right. So, yes, Spitzer, the infrared telescope, studies heat radiation. And you might say, okay, well, why are you interested in studying heat radiation? So this is light that comes from things that are colder than stars in space. So it's a very simple, you know, so Spitzer is used to study things that you can't see with your visible eyes, much the same way that on the ground firefighters use infrared cameras to look for objects that are not glowing in visible light. Like, they can see flames just before they start, look for hot spots in walls. And so Spitzer looks for things that are colder than stars, such as objects that are just about to become stars called protostars. It can also study the emission from planets themselves, which are cooler than stars, and other objects that are in our solar system, which are asteroids and comets, which you can see in reflected light, but they're a lot easier to see in their own heat radiation. So that's one of the purposes and benefits of the infrared. Another one is the fact that heat radiation, because it's a longer wavelength light, as you mentioned, allows it to penetrate things that block the visible light. So gas and dust, which I just mentioned, are all between the stars, the infrared gets more easily through that, just like infrared light gets more easily through smoke in a fire, or reddish light we see more coming through the atmosphere as the sun sets, right? That's the same concept, is that all the shorter wavelength colors get blocked by the atmosphere because you're looking through more of it, and the red light, the infrared light from the sun gets through. So Spitzer allows us to see colder objects and allows us to see through obscuring material in between us and the things we're interested in studying, which may be planets, stars, and distant galaxies.
Yeah, and you made me think of, the satellites we use here on Earth to penetrate through the clouds of smoke, for especially at night, for the firefighters to see in infrared wavelengths where the hot spots are in these giant fires burning throughout the West.
Yep, exactly the same principle. The one other thing that astronomers do, which isn't a terrestrial kind of application of the infrared, and this it goes back to some physics of the expansion of the universe, is that allows us to see the most distant objects more easily. And the reason for that is because the universe is expanding as the light goes from galaxies that are far away, and we're looking at them as they were early in the universe, the light expands along with it. So it gets progressively redder and redder. So when astronomers talk about this thing called redshift, what they mean is the light, as you look further back in time and at objects further away, gets redder and redder. So the visible light coming from galaxies very far away gets shifted to longer and longer, redder and redder wavelengths until you can't see it with your eyes anymore or with an optical telescope. And then you need the infrared to look at those galaxies.
Ah, I see. And then also, we should mention that the reason we have to have this telescope in space, and I'm going to ask you some questions about the telescope and where it is in a moment, but it's also it's true that these infrared wavelengths are blocked by water, aren't they? So that's why we have to get out of the atmosphere to really be able to detect all this information. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, you can do a little bit of infrared from the ground, but it's going back to your analogy of putting on the mask underwater. It's like putting on the mask and then putting on binoculars or a microscope if you want to be able to see the fish. You just get a much better view when you're above the atmosphere.
Well, give us a sense of, it was launched in 2003, correct?
That's correct.
And how big is the Spitzer Space Telescope? Give us an idea of how big this machine is.
So Spitzer is not a large telescope. It's only got an 85-centimeter mirror. So that's about a third the size of the Hubble Space Telescope. And so it's about a tenth the size in collecting area. But what makes Spitzer powerful is the type of light, the infrared light that you're looking at. One of the reasons it's small is that when Spitzer was built, that was the era for NASA, smarter, faster, cheaper, so it was intentionally scaled down. The other reason, too, is that because it looks for heat radiation, you got to get Spitzer away from sources of heat radiation like the Earth for it to operate very well. So Spitzer is in what's called an Earth-trailing orbit around the sun. Same thing as the Kepler Space Telescope, though Kepler was launched later. So Spitzer is a pathfinder for this kind of orbit. And the idea with Spitzer was that you get it away from the Earth so you don't have all that heat radiation from the Earth contaminating your view. The other thing with Spitzer is because it's looking for heat radiation from very distant, very cold objects, you have to keep the telescope very cold. Because if the telescope was warm, just the infrared light from the telescope would obscure your vision. The way that was done is that the telescope was cooled two ways. One is by blocking all sources of heat. So it has a shiny side, which is always pointed towards the sun. And that's also where the solar panels are, which power the telescope. And then the backside of the telescope, which is in the shadow of those solar rays, is painted black. So then any excess heat that leaks through is radiated in a cold space. So that allows Spitzer to keep pretty cold. And then at the beginning, it had a tank of helium. Liquid helium, which was used to cool the telescope, mirror, and the instruments aboard Spitzer, because there are three different instruments on Spitzer.
And then eventually, of course, that coolant ran out, right?
That's right. In about May 2009, the coolant ran out. And at that point, we're like, okay, well, what that meant was that Spitzer was no longer able to use the two longest or reddest or infrareddest instruments. So it was down to one set of cameras. So we had four short wavelength cameras, and two of those still work, with Spitzer being cold, but not as cold as it was. And when I say cold, right now Spitzer is a little cooler than 30 degrees above absolute zero. In the mission, when we had the cryogen, the mirror itself was between 5 and 10 degrees above absolute zero. So that's all really cold compared to temperatures on Earth.
Wow, that's almost as cold as it gets out in space, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. So one thing we learned from Spitzer, though, is that if you're clever about the engineering and you keep sources of light and heat away from the telescope, without packing any coolant at all, you can cool a telescope to less than 30 degrees above absolute zero. So that's a technology that's being used for all future telescopes, infrared telescopes, including the James Webb Space Telescope.
And let's talk a bit about some of the amazing discoveries and findings from this telescope as we celebrate its 15 years of operation. If I ask you, like, what's one of your absolute favorite things? Because there's lots of them. What's the one that comes to your mind?
So flat out, my favorite thing is it's something I got to participate in. And it was one of those wow moments when we first saw the data, was our observations of the TRAPPIST-1 system. So TRAPPIST-1 was a system which was, it's a very small, cool star called an ultra-cool dwarf. So it's about the tenth the size of the sun and about half the temperature. So it's actually pretty cool. And it gives off a lot of light in the infrared. So it's easy for Spitzer to study. And astronomers using ground-based telescopes, one to study if there were planets around these very cold stars, Mikkel Guyon and his crew. And they saw some interesting signatures of planets going around the star, transiting in front and blocking a little bit of the light. But it was very puzzling what they saw. So then we followed that up with Spitzer. And one of the things we're able to do with Spitzer, because it's in this Earth-trailing orbit, so it's not orbiting around the Earth, it can stare at things for a very long period of time. So we stared at the TRAPPIST-1 system for 20 days. And when we saw the first 10 days' worth of data, I was walked in the office of one of my colleagues who had just we've done a quick processing of the data, and we saw all these dips in the star. When we stare at it, you get a light curve. So you measure how bright the star is, and you see how that varies as a function of time. And when a planet passes in front of the star, you get a dip because the planet's blocking a little bit of the star when it transits or goes in front. And we saw a lot of dips, and we kept starting. And we were just like, "Wow, that's a lot of planets in there. Much more than they had figured at first. They thought maybe there were two to three. What we found with Spitzer is that there's seven planets orbiting TRAPPIST-1 that we know about. All these planets are roughly Earth-sized. And then we continued to study the TRAPPIST-1 system with Spitzer. So we spent 500 hours looking at the initially just staring for 20 days. And then we spent another 500 hours just following up transits of these planets. And with that, we're able to measure the masses of the planets as well. So now we know the masses and the radii of these planets, the sizes of these planets, to very good accuracy. So we know the densities of these planets as well. Is that just the mass divided by the volume of the planet? To better than 10%, which is, it's astonishing. I mean, we know more about these planets than we do any other planets except for the ones in our own solar system, which, you know, we can actually send rovers and cameras and things like to study. So the TRAPPIST system is just amazing.
How far away is it?
So it's not far by astronomical standards. It's 40 light years away, but it's pretty far by terrestrial standards.
I was doing a back of the envelope calculation the other day about, the fastest thing that we can send is Voyager. And, just for it to get to a light year away is 20,000 years worth of travel time. So that's a long ways away for humans.
Yeah, we're not going to be going to TRAPPIST-1 anytime soon, that's for sure.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll finish our conversation with Spitzer Science Center's staff astronomer, Sean Carey. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. And thanks for listening. What are some of the intriguing things about these planets, the exoplanets of TRAPPIST-1, that you've pondered from the data from Spitzer?
So they're all sort of about this, you know, they're all about the same size as Earth. You know, some are a little bit smaller, some are a little bit larger. Three of the planets, if you take into account how bright the star is and how close the planets are, they're at distances where it would be possible, if the chemistry on the planet and their atmospheric properties, it's possible on those planets that there could be liquid water on the surfaces. The temperature would be right if there was water on these planets as part of their composition. Some of that could be liquid. That's actually really interesting because pretty much we know on Earth, any place there's liquid water, there's life. So we kind of think of liquid water as being one of the precursors to life. So it's a very interesting possibility that there could be liquid water on some of the TRAPPIST-1 planets, and then they would have the potential for having life or being able to harbor life in the future.
Wow. And then when the James Webb Space Telescope is launched in the future, we might, you know, be able to find a few more answers about things like that, might we?
Yeah, really excited for the launch of James Webb because, so Spitzer, we're able to measure the masses and the sizes of the planets, but because James Webb has so much more collecting area and its instrumentation suite is much better. In fact, one of the things Webb will be able to do is do the same sort of observations as Spitzer, but it'll be able to split the light into many individual colors. And when it does that, it can actually look for signatures of, well, first, whether or not there's atmospheres on these planets. And the way it will do that is it'll see that the size of the planet will change as a function of color. And the reason it does that, if the planets were just rocky, just bare rock, you wouldn't see any change as a function of color. But if there's an atmosphere, as we know from our atmosphere, atmosphere blocks different colors of light selectively, so you'll see the size of the planet get bigger and smaller as a function of color or wavelength, and that'll tell you something about, first, if there's an atmosphere, and second, what's in the atmosphere. So it'll be able to tell us if there's water, if there's methane, if there's carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide. So that'd be really exciting if we can kind of get a chemical fingerprint of an atmosphere of one of these planets, which are presumably otherwise terrestrial in nature.
Or even more exciting, free oxygen.
Yeah, free oxygen would be very cool.
Which would indicate that, you know, some living thing may be putting the oxygen there, like plants.
Right. And also, if you know, you get a right abundance of methane to ozone to carbon dioxide, that's another signature too, but that's not as conclusive.
Wow. Well, okay. Well, there's your number one on your personal Spitzer hit parade. How about another one?
Okay. So another one I think is pretty interesting, and this is due to the fact that Spitzer is now so far away from the Earth, which for all other purposes causes problems, because the further you get away from the Earth, the harder it is to communicate with Spitzer, which makes for a lot of interesting engineering challenges. Right now, it's 1.6 astronomical units away from the Earth. And an astronomical unit is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun. So Spitzer is pretty far away from the Earth. But because of that, we get a totally different viewing geometry of our solar system. So we're able to look at near-Earth asteroids that have been discovered and then characterize those better with Spitzer as they fly closer to Spitzer than they do the Earth. And then the other thing we're able to look at is we're able to measure the masses of planets that are detected by a technique called gravitational microlensing. And this happens when two stars align as we see them, and the foreground star, which you may or may not be able to see, magnifies, lenses the light from the background star through its gravity. And if that foreground star happens to have a planet, sometimes that planet also, its gravity is able to either magnify or demagnify the background star, and from that you can detect the planet. And the interesting thing about these planets is that they're the most like the distances from the planet to their star where you're most likely to see this signature is when they're about the star is about the size of our sun, then the planet would be between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. So kind of what you call the snow line of a system, which those types of planets are almost impossible to see with any other technique we have now. So with microlensing, we're able to get an idea of looking for things like analogs of Jupiter in our own solar system. And what Spitzer does, because it can see the event from a different geometry allows us to very precisely measure the masses of those planets. So we've seen things that are from half or so a Jupiter mass to several times the mass of Jupiter, orbiting distances between one astronomical unit to more than three astronomical units from their stars. So I thought that's pretty cool too.
The next thing I wanted to talk to you about is what would you say is like the big picture legacy of Spitzer? What has it really done?
Okay, so Spitzer has transformed our understanding of our universe from the structure of our own solar system, where it detected the largest ring around Saturn, which is gigantic compared to any of the others and only seen in the infrared, to discovering and measuring the properties of planets around other stars, to weighing the masses of the most distant galaxies in the universe. Spitzer is able to see the light from galaxies. The record holder right now, the light is coming from 13.4 billion years ago, so about 400 million years after the start of the big, from 400 million years from the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. So Spitzer's just given us everything from our own solar system to the furthest stretches of the cosmos and everything in between.
Well, Dr. Sean Carey, manager of the Spitzer Science Center at Caltech, thanks for sharing with us your expertise and your knowledge of the Spitzer Space Telescope as we celebrate 15 years of it in operation.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thanks to Spitzer Science Center staff astronomer Sean Carey. He joined us from Caltech in Pasadena via Skype. Next, we talked to the project scientist for Spitzer. Mike Werner has served as Spitzer project scientist since 1984. Werner was named the 2006 George Darwin Lecturer by the Royal Astronomical Society in recognition of the success of Spitzer and is also the recipient of two NASA Outstanding Leadership Medals. Mike Werner, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Mike, as I recall, I was a senior in high school in 1977 when you started working on this project. And I remember reading about the original plan for this was to have an infrared telescope in the space shuttle cargo bay. Is that right? And if that's true, could you explain to us how that evolved into the orbiting telescope that we have now?
Right. You're absolutely correct. At that time, what is now Spitzer was called the Shuttle Infrared Telescope Facility. The idea was it would fly in the space shuttle for a couple of weeks, be brought back to Earth, be refurbished, maybe have a new instrument installed, and fly again in 2 or 3 months for another couple of weeks. This was, of course, totally unrealistic for a number of reasons. And in 1983, while the CERTIF concept was still being in its infancy, the IRAS satellite was the first orbiting observatory for infrared astronomy. It showed that the technology was available to have a free-flying mission. It also showed that the science was really compelling. And at that point, CERTIF got promoted to become the Space Infrared Telescope Facility. Then it evolved in that form for a number of years until around 1989 or 1990. At that point, on the one hand, it was being considered by a committee, the Decadal Review Committee chaired by John Bacall, for a top slot as the next major infrared or next major astrophysical observatory in space. But on the other hand, it was becoming very expensive. And things like the problem with the Hubble spherical aberration, the loss of Mars Observer, and so forth, made really expensive projects sort of unpopular, if not unwanted and unsellable. So at the same time that we were named the highest priority mission for the 1990s, we were faced with a dramatic challenge to de-scope the mission, make it much smaller and less expensive. And in order to do that, we hit upon the idea of putting Spitzer into an orbit around the sun, not around the Earth, which made it a much better thermal environment for the coolant that we were carrying to make Spitzer sensitive in the infrared. And it evolved from that into a system which because of the way it's constructed and its orbit, stays cold even after the cryogen has evaporated. So that initial cryogen liquid helium lasted about 6 years, and we've gone about 9 years since then in what we call the warm mission, although it's really about 35 degrees above absolute zero. Finally, it was named Spitzer for the astrophysicist Lyman Spitzer after the first data came in the fall of 2003. We had a press release, announced the results, and announced that it had been named for Lyman Spitzer.
And of course, you mentioned earlier, you know, the more famous Big Brother Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, and its spherical aberration, which is basically that its mirror was not configured properly to focus it, and of course that was famously fixed by those heroic space shuttle missions by the astronauts. But could you give us a sense of how Spitzer observations have worked, dovetailed with Hubble, how they work together to give astronomers a bigger picture, a more refined view of the astrophysical objects they study?
Now that's a really, really good question. And the first point to bear in mind is that Spitzer and Hubble work in different parts of the spectrum. Hubble works in the optical, the ultraviolet, and the near-infrared, as we call it, the shorter wavelength infrared radiation. Spitzer works with longer wavelength infrared radiation, and the spectral coverage of the two observatories, if you want to look at it that way, abut. You know, they're side by side. So when you're observing with Hubble, if you find something interesting, the next thing you might want to do is look at the object with Spitzer to see what's going on there. So in the case of the distant galaxies, Hubble is very good, because of its high precision, at selecting interesting candidates and at determining their distances, because that information lies in the part of the spectrum that Hubble has access to, whereas Spitzer, following up on a Hubble discovery, can determine what the mass of the galaxy is, what the age of the stars that make it up are, and also help to confirm that it is in fact a distant galaxy rather than an interloper, if you like, or a wolf in sheep's clothing sort of masquerading as a distant galaxy when it's really something else. Similarly, when we're studying exoplanets, the adjacent spectral regions sample different molecular constituents of the atmosphere of an exoplanet. So putting them together, we get a much better picture of what the atmosphere of an exoplanet might be than if we had only one of the observatories and not the pair of them. And then down the line, if you like, there are many other areas where they're synergistic. They're both members of the same family, NASA's family of great observatories.
Let's talk a bit about the Milky Way, because you know, we live in a solar system in one of the spiral arms of the Milky Way, which is full of giant clouds of gas and dust, which obscure our view of the galaxy and makes it hard to know, you know, what does the Milky Way really look like? What is the structure of it? What's going on? Because you're inside of the darn thing and these clouds obscure it. But Spitzer's really revolutionized our understanding of the galaxy. Could you kind of go into some detail on that and describe for us what we've learned about our own galaxy from the Spitzer observations?
Well, I think this again was a big surprise to those of us who worked on the mission, but it turns out that Spitzer is so sensitive that it can see fairly ordinary stars right to the edge of the galaxy, even looking through the plane where dust and gas obscure visible light, which is more readily observed by the dust clouds. So with Spitzer, we've been able to confirm previous suggestions that our galaxy is a barred spiral galaxy, which is one where the spiral arms don't go all the way into the center of the galaxy, but they terminate at the edges of a bar of stars, which in the case of our galaxy has been confirmed by Spitzer, extends over perhaps 10 or 12,000 light years, starting at the galactic center. So that by itself was a major result from Spitzer. In addition, Spitzer has shown that the plane of the galaxy is full of what are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, a kind of a carbon-bearing molecule similar to things which are fairly ordinary on the Earth, but whose existence was known, but not its persistence throughout the galaxy. We've also studied the very central region of our galaxy, where there's a black hole, which is accreting, which is not accreting, but only very weakly accreting. Normally, in some circumstances, a black hole will gobble up lots of matter from nearby stars and clouds of dust and gas and become extraordinarily luminous. The black hole at the center of our galaxy, which was discovered by infrared observations, has been shown by Spitzer to sort of be sporadically accreting and occasionally hiccuping. And what we're learning from that study is helping us better understand the same type of phenomena which occur on a much more dramatic scale in other nearby galaxies. In addition, we have, since Spitzer, a wonderful panoramic vista of the plane of our galaxy, which shows all of the star clusters, the interstellar matter, the loops of gas and dust in a totally splendid way. And that can be accessed if you look at the Spitzer website, spitzer.caltech.edu, and put in the keyword GLIMPSE, which is the name of the survey that generated those images.
Yeah, that's really spectacular. Well, Mike Werner, project scientist for the Spitzer Space Telescope, as we celebrate Spitzer at 15, thanks so much for your time and sharing these stories with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks to our guests from Caltech, home of the Spitzer Science Center and the Spitzer Space Telescope. Lisa Story Lombardi, the project manager, Spitzer Science Center staff astronomer and director Sean Carey, and project scientist Mike Werner. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. We're distributed through PRX, so if you're podcasting this, tell your local NPR station to give us a try. Speaking of podcasting, you can check out this and all the episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe via NPR Podcasts. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz, and as always, Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.